And welcome. Thank you so much for joining me, Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, right here on Progressive Radio Network. And you can find us at prn.fm, where you can hear all of our shows, The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, as well as all the other fascinating shows that are broadcast regularly at Progressive Radio Network. Today, we are so happy to have as our guest Michael J. Balick. Dr. Balick holds a Ph.D. in biology from Harvard University and is Vice President for Botanical Science, Director and Philology Curator of the Institute of Economic Botany at the New York Botanical Gardens. An ethnobotanist with a specialty in global medicinal and food plants and the role they play in traditional healing systems, Dr. Balick has conducted fieldwork with indigenous cultures around the world for more than 30 years. On today's show, we will discuss his new book, 21st Century Herbal, a practical guide for healthy living using nature's most powerful plants. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Balick.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you for having me, Ellen.
Now, you have a really fascinating history. So why don't you share with our listeners, going back in time, what led you to become an ethnobotanist?
Well, the history actually begins in my grandparents' vegetable garden when I was 4 or 5 years old, looking at cucumbers and being totally amazed that they would grow an inch in a day or two. You know, into a young child, that was phenomenal. Or you could plant a marigold seed in the spring and harvest thousands of those same seeds in the fall. And one thing led to another, and I became absolutely possessed by this kind of fascination between the relationship between plants, people, and culture, which I learned later was the science of ethnobotany.
Yes, and that's interesting because when we see histories on TV about famous, let's say, musicians, very often they picked up a drum or a guitar by the time they were two. So it seems like there's this desire that is not only bred through interaction in your environment with family influences, but something that you come in with, and then you have been able to follow that and make it your profession as well as your love.
Absolutely.
I feel fortunate that way as well because my grandmother was an herbalist, and she's the one who started me off on that same path. Now, you do a lot of work in the indigenous cultures around the world. So what does a trip with you look like?
Well, there's no one template. Most recently, I'm coming back from the Pacific Island nation of Vanuatu, and that involved dozens of hours each way in an airplane to a beautiful tropical location with friendly people who are interested in understanding their biological diversity and preserving their culture, plant-based culture. You know, around the world, we have probably 350,000 species of flowering plants. A number of these are endangered, and people are worried about that. So going out to live in small villages and sitting with grandparents and asking them about the use of plants that they would like to share, medicines, foods, how you prepare certain foods or food preservation, what the relationship is between foods and health and medicine, collecting plant samples. Do you remember when you were probably in the first grade, you went out and collected colored leaves in the fall, maples and oaks, and put them between wax paper and ironed them? Did you do that?
I certainly did that, and I'm sure most of our listeners did as well. It was usually a class project.
Yeah, so basically we're preserving plants that people have talked about as not only having uses, but plants that are present in their environment. And here at the New York Botanical Garden, we have a collection of dried plants called a herbarium of over 7.4 million individual specimens. They're not dried between wax paper. They're actually mounted on rag bond paper with a label on the lower right that talks about where they were collected and who the collectors were and any uses and plant descriptions that might be available. So the goal is vouchering the plants that people talk about, not only with photos and videos, but actually collecting plant samples themselves. And those herbarium specimens can last indefinitely. And we have some that are hundreds and hundreds of years old.
What a fabulous resource, both for the serious student and the community, and that's at nybg.org. That's the New York Botanical Gardens. Is any of that available online as something that people can thumb through that way, or do you actually have to visit the garden?
No, you can go on the CV Star Virtual Herbarium of the New York Botanical Garden, and you can see many tens of thousands, I think, we're up to a million herbarium specimens being digitized, and a number of those have images. So the goal is to digitize most of those specimens that we have and make images. And you can imagine that's a very long-term goal.
Right, but even to have any of them there is so phenomenal, because then we're talking about worldwide access. And it really makes it multicultural in terms of the input that we can have in sharing plants.
Yes, and in fact, we've just embarked on a project with a number of other institutions to produce a World Flora Online, so that those 350,000 species would have descriptions and images and keys are used to identify plants. Eventually those 350,000 species would be accessible online to everyone around the world. Some of my colleagues call it the democratization of botany.
That's a good name, because it actually makes it then widely accessible. A child like you were, let's say, mm-hmm. a five-year-old, who mm-hmm. they're pretty savvy online there, who suddenly finds themselves being drawn into plants to, you know, a seasoned botanist somewhere else in a very remote area of the world. So it's just fantastic. And we do similar things. Myself and my partner, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, actually lead for 32 years, I believe it's our 32nd year of doing this, and we visit indigenous cultures in Jamaica and Costa Rica, where we actually know specific individuals, mm-hmm. and have studied with them many years in terms of looking at the medicinal plants they use, and then we take little samples of that to the Natural Product Chemistry Laboratory at the University of West Indies in Kingston. And we work with a gentleman there who's able to break down and look at the actives. And that's interesting, because although we know the medicines work, or it would not have been passed down traditionally, and I'm sure you find that as well, but what we can do as scientists is actually try to elucidate the mechanism of action and help explain why those things work.
Yes, and speaking of Costa Rica, I'd invite you or your listeners to go to Finca Luna Nueva and see the Sacred Seeds Garden, the Semilla Sagrada Garden, where a group of people have built a garden and collected maybe 400 or 500, I don't know what the current total is, 500 different species of medicinal plants that people can look at, taste, smell, and learn about the use of plants in medicine. And these sacred seed gardens are all over the world, and the goal is preserving not only the genetic diversity of the medicinal plants, but also knowledge about those plants, which, as you say, is so important.
And sometimes what we find is some of these ancient healers, like you personally know, their own relatives and children are often not so interested in carrying forth that lineage. And I find that that's what's leading many of the older indigenous healers and kuantadhas around the world to be open to sharing to with outside people, because sometimes I even feel like we've been sent to write down and bring their knowledge forward into the future.
I think that's a really important point. The traditional leaders are deeply concerned about the transmission of information to the next generation and the following generation, and they view our partnership with them, the traditional leaders, as a way of exciting the younger people about the importance of this work. We've just finished 25 years of research in Belize. My colleague, Dr. Rosita Arvigo, and I are shortly publishing a book on the useful plants of Belize, and there are over 975 species. And, of course, Belize is a great tourist, ecotourist destination. And when we talk to the young people who are the tour guides, they say, well, you know, my grandfather was a great healer, and my father as well, and I was more interested in the modern sort of life, and now that I'm making my income teaching traditional knowledge to the visitors, I have no one to turn to but these books that you and Dr. Arvigo and others have produced, and really it's a way of preserving the knowledge through practice, as well as showing an economic incentive.
Well, I am very much looking forward to your new book with Rosita. She has been on this radio show and many shows that we do many times, and we've even had her on once all the way from Belize. And that was really exciting because she had listeners tuning in from there because the show was online as well as all around the world. So I am very much looking forward to that book when it comes out.
That'll be the winter of 2015, Oxford University Press.
Oh, well, that's soon.
Yep.
It's around the corner. So you guys have been working on that for sure.
Yes.
I remember taking a group of pharmacists and MDs in Jamaica up into the bush for a few days, and we collected moringa, noni. Mm-hmm. And they were amazed. They said, well, their relatives, when they were children, had always given it to them, and they called it Duppy Soursop. Now they were grown adults, and they were highly trained professionals and educated pharmacists and physicians, and they actually were buying commercial noni juice in jars for something like $40 a bottle, and they completely did not know that that was the exact plant that had been shared with them by their grandparents. So quickly that knowledge could be lost.
Yes, and we have a curator at the New York Botanical Garden, Dr. Ina Vandenbroek, who just came back from Jamaica, from Portland Parish, and she's got a project to compare traditional knowledge of medicinal plants in Jamaica and then how it changes or how it evolves when Jamaicans come to New York City. Where do they get their plants? Which ones do they use? Do they learn about new species from other Caribbean peoples or from other regions of the world? It's a fascinating thing to think about the flow of information. And we published a paper a few years ago showing that some of this knowledge, instead of losing it, it actually grows when people immigrate.
Well, I would love to speak to her about that. I'll get to you after off air on that, because we usually go to St. Mary's Parish.
Mm-hmm.
That's the place that our people actually live. So it is just amazing that the work that you have been doing all these years and this particular book, 21st Century Herbal, is so comprehensive because it discusses these ethnobotanical events that you talk about, and it's also beautiful and full color. But you do so much more in this book. For instance, a really interesting topic is the global history of herbal medicine. I think people think that, you know, just because herbal supplements are in jars now, they just got invented, or, you know, I don't know what they think. They usually are not aware of the long traditional history that spans really since the beginning of human life.
Well, we can go back 60,000 years to a Neanderthal man who was buried with herbs in his grave, like yarrow. And we know yarrow has been used for ages as a styptic to stop the flow of blood from a wound or a cut and for other dermatological purposes. And then we can move up to the earliest recorded medical text, which was a Mesopotamian Sumerian clay tablet about 2400 BC. And it had 250 different herbal remedies on this clay tablet. You can see that at the University of Pennsylvania Museum. And from there, it continued. There's a genre of books called herbals. The oldest that we have at the New York Botanical Garden Library is from 1275. And these herbals were the textbooks for physicians who were learning about the plants that they used in their medical practice, as well as families kept them in their homes, and they used them to treat illness. And for this book, Rodale's 21st Century Herbal, I was inspired by a copy of Gerard's Herbal, a book from 1597, that was one of the major herbals in English that taught people about all sorts of cures for medical problems. So this what we try to do in the current book is build on these great herbal traditions. It's a fabulous line of medical texts, and I called it 21st Century Herbal because I thought that there should be a contemporary one, because we're very interested as a public, as a community, in getting good information about the use of herbs to improve our lives.
It is. And of course, even such things as preparation is so important, which you do discuss in here as well. And the fact that herbs are not all 100% safe all of the time, but if we compare them with pharmaceutical drugs, they have a much better risk-benefit ratio.
Yes, and I always say work with an integrative physician if you're taking these things, you know, these modalities, herbal modalities. There can be some interactions, but in general, as you point out, they're fairly safe. But always work with a physician. Something as simple as grapefruit. Everyone knows now that if you're taking statins, you can't eat grapefruit. And there's a compound in grapefruit that actually makes the statins many times stronger in your body. So, you know, plants and foods and compounds can all have impacts.
Yes, that's great information. Now, in your book, of course, you do start out with a big history, and you talk about the pharmacopoeias of the past, and then you do move into how to actually use different plants medicinally. And I guess that's the part that you're saying is an herbal. You look at specific herbs, the kind of dose that would normally be used, and, you know, all of the information that somebody could use to start with some easy-to-use plants.
Yes. What I cover 180 different species in the book, some common things, and then some things that are not as common. And each of them can be grown in your garden. So not only is this herbal sort of pathway to knowledge about the uses of herbs, but it's also a garden book, how to design your herb garden, whether you're living in an apartment and you might have a terrace or want to grow things on your window, or whether you have a big farm upstate or out west somewhere. You can grow your own herbs. You can process them. There are a lot of recipes for processing and making tinctures and extracts and making household cleaning products using plant-based ingredients. Lots of different things.
Well, we're going to take just a little break right here, Dr. Balick, and when we come back, we will reintroduce you and we will continue looking at the many, many topics that you cover in great detail in your new book, Rodale's 21st Century Herbal, Michael Balick, and the foreword is by Dr. Andrew Weil. So we will be right back with more.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll talk about high blood pressure or hypertension.
Hypertension or high blood pressure is a disease of the Western world and a product of modern civilization. Cultures that continue to adhere to an indigenous lifestyle, which includes low stress levels, a non-refined whole foods diet, as well as vigorous exercise, experience virtually no episodes of essential hypertension. It is very interesting to note that when individuals from these societies emigrate to Western countries and adopt Western habits, they too fall prey to hypertension. Naturopathic treatment of hypertension has not changed essentially in the last century. The mainstay of the treatment still relies on diet, exercise, stress reduction, lifestyle modification, with secondary support from other modalities such as hypotensive phytotherapy or herbal medicine, hydrotherapy, which is the therapeutic use of water, clinical nutrition, as well as homeopathy. We'll focus on phytotherapy in this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest.
Let's talk about Taraxacum officinalis. This is an unpopular nuisance to many homeowners trying to build that perfect lawn. However, this common weed, the dandelion, is a powerful yet safe botanical medicine for the treatment of hypertension. In a Romania study in 1974, the common dandelion was found to be as potent a diuretic as a commonly used drug called Lasix. Dandelion, however, due to its rich levels of potassium, acted against potassium ion depletion, a dangerous condition known as hypokalemia, seen as a side effect of many antihypertensive drugs which promote diuresis. The leaf of the dandelion was a more effective medicine than the root, although the root is utilized by naturopathic physicians and has a powerful liver-specific medicinal quality.
Crataegus oxycantha, also known in the vernacular as hawthorn, is a common tree in the family Rosaceae, or the rose family. Extracts of the plant in the Western literature date back far beyond the Middle Ages. Even the Chinese were privy to its usage, especially as a digestive tonic. The therapeutic principles are found in extracts from the leaves, berry-like fruits, as well as the flowers. In Europe, Crataegus is well respected for its effects at lowering blood pressure, blood lipids, reducing angina attacks, and preventing and perhaps reversing atherosclerotic deposition in arterial walls. This plant has demonstrated a remarkable safety record, but because of its powerful effects, it should not be used with certain cardiac or hypotensive drugs and should be used by a qualified practitioner of alternative medicine.
Other herbs are also helpful for hypertension, such as garlic, olive, and olive oil, and ginkgo biloba.
So if the pressures of life are making your blood boil, don't forget about these herbal medicines the next time you reach into the Natural Medicine Chest.
Welcome back once again to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, and we love to hear from you. You can find us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And we have lots of classes that you can attend both online, herbal certification class online. You can also come out with us in the field, where we do edible and medicinal plant identification and medicine-making workshops so that you can take home your own projects, some of which there's wonderful recipes about in the book we're discussing today with Dr. Balick. And you can also join us in Chinatown, where we walk around and learn a lot about traditional Chinese medicine and meet very many Chinese traditional Chinese physicians and just immerse ourselves in a different culture for a day. And we also are part of the Naval Expo. You can go to navalexpo.com. That's an event that occurs twice a year on Long Island, where hundreds of natural health care providers get together and share knowledge with the community. We also have a 6.25 contact hour professional course in evidence-based natural medicine, and that's coming up in the fall at the University of Bridgeport. So lots of information to share. We'd love to hear from you. And today we're so happy to have as our guest Dr. Michael Balick. He has a PhD in biology from Harvard University and currently is the Vice President for Botanical Science, Director, and Phylicology Curator of the Institute of Economic Botany at the New York Botanical Gardens. He is an ethnobotanist with a specialty, as we've been discussing, in global medicine and food plants and the role they play in traditional healing systems. And on today's show, we are focusing on his book, Rodale's 21st Century Herbal. So thank you so much for rejoining us right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Hello, is Dr. Balick
yes,
there?
Yes.
Oh, there you are. Yeah, there was time for you to take a break, so we're back. So, you know, one of the things that I'm doing is actually using your book as a textbook. And the reason I decided to do that is because I wanted something that was published recently, and I believe this is a 2014 title.
Yes, it just came out.
So that was one of the parameters, because, of course, you've written books in the past that are excellent. There's really a lot of information in some very, very good textbooks and books that can be used. But this is really special. Because you talk about, let's say, the different ways that herbs are used. And these are the kinds of things that we use when we're teaching herbal medicine, like synergistic, additive, and antagonistic in terms of the effects that herbs might have together when they are used. Do you find that all cultures recognize these kinds of relationships?
Yes, Ellen. There are a lot of mixtures in the preparations, medicinal preparations, in the different cultures that I've worked with. People have, they're experimentalists. You know, it's very interesting that without laboratory equipment, they seem to have come up with ways of processing out toxins from their foods or potentiating the effects of their herbs. And a lot of these, particularly in Southeast Asia, are complex mixtures.
Well, that's really interesting because one of the things we found when we were in Jamaica this year at the Natural Product Chemistry Laboratory is that what they did there was they made a preparation of a particular plant the way it's done, and we'll say the word, in the bush, and that means by the traditional healers, how they would usually prepare a plant for medicinal use, and it was a simple tea. So that would be something like an infusion, we would call it, if we understand the language of herbal medicine, or just making a tea, close to just making a tea. So that's the way it's always been used, and it has a nice effect. When they made an alcohol extract in the laboratory, first they tinctured it, and then they took out some of the alcohol and made it a little bit more like a decoction, they found that there was a very high level of a particular toxic chemical when it was made that way, which did not occur in the traditional way it was used as an infusion.
Very interesting.
So sometimes, you know, Mother knows best.
I think you brought up a really good point. The way people use herbs traditionally is not necessarily the way they're processed in commercial supplements. Alcohol, acetone, other solvents can be used to extract compounds that weren't really the focus of the traditional use.
Well, also, what is your feeling between using the whole plant versus something that's becoming very popular more recently, which is called standardization?
Well, standardization assumes that there's a single chemical in the herb that can be measured and used to sort of judge the quality and dosage of the herb. And unfortunately, with some of the herbs, we're not sure in commercial preparations that people have standardized or selected the right compound, the active compound. So that's a tough call. I like whole herb extracts. I like making my own when I can, but buying supercritical extracts that have been processed with carbon dioxide instead of nail polish remover. You know, there are lots of things used to process these formulas. But sometimes standardization works. It certainly works in allopathic medicine, pharmaceutical medicine, but it doesn't always work in the realm of plants.
Well, that's something that I think is wonderful to debate, because so many people, especially in the more commercial end and the way herbs are being used so widely now, are really focusing on that standardization technique. And like you said, there's a lot of problems. For one thing, every company does not necessarily standardize to the same active. And also, as you pointed out, if you take out that one active, although it might have an effect, you're losing a lot of the compounds that would be found in the plant that seem to offset possible adverse effects.
Correct.
I think a good example is white willow bark. While we know that salicylic acid, in its pure form, let's say aspirin, can have gastrointestinal irritating effects, white willow bark doesn't seem to, because although it has similar actives, it also has slight mucilages that coat the stomach. So it's just so amazing how everything's put together perfect by nature.
Yes, and I think there are many tens of thousands of herbs that traditional cultures around the world have used in their history, and we only know a few hundred of them, or maybe 500 of them up here. And so one of the great joys in my work is working with these cultures who use things other than we're aware of, or and to try and document that, because gosh, I think there's tens of thousands of years of research remaining to be done on perhaps there are 30,000 different species of medicinal plants that have been collected over the years, and it's a pretty big challenge.
Well, of course, this isn't your first discussion about this, because you have another wonderful book, Plants, People, and Culture, The Science of Ethnobotany. So, you know, this is something you've been focusing on such a long time.
Well, I was lucky to have really good mentors in undergraduate school and graduate school, and they really supported that love of nature and plants, and, you know, wanting to work outside instead of inside, and wanting to talk to people about how they related to plants, whether they were ornamental or medicinal or food or magical. You know, plants are the basis for many spiritual beliefs. So, yes, we in Plants, People, and Culture, Dr. Paul Cox and I wrote about our experiences in the Amazon and Central America and his work in the Pacific.
And that's, you know, that's something that was written in 1996. So you've been doing it a very long time and have a deep understanding. Now, I think the Botanical Gardens is such a great place, because you often change what people can see there. So even if they've been there before, there might be something else. I know there was an ethnogen layout a few years ago that I came to see. That was really wonderful, about psychoactive plants. And you had great examples of them growing there.
Yes, we had an exhibit called Wild Medicine, and we displayed, I believe it was over 1,000, perhaps more, 2,000 species of plants used by traditional cultures. And for those of your listeners who want a taste of that, who missed that, I think it was two summers ago, from January 24th to February 22nd, we're going to have an exhibition in the Ina de Haupt Conservatory called Wild Medicine in the Tropics. And people will be able to walk through the conservatory and discover plants used for health and wellness, tropical species.
Oh, that's great, because we do that a lot in Florida. My home base is in Florida. So, of course, we have a completely different group of plants there than here in the New York area. But we have plenty here as well. There's biodiversity wherever you go.
Yes.
And the knowledge of that has been lost. But like I say, wherever I lecture in the country, and in fact in the world, you know, did people live here before there were shopping centers? If so, there's edible and medicinal plants around you, especially if you don't do too much gardening, like putting in sod and spraying with lots of chemicals. Just growing, usually in the wild, often in waste places, are things that are edible and medicinal.
You know, you can be an ethnobotanist anywhere. I ask my audiences to remember what their grandmother or grandfather or mom or dad gave them when they had a stomach ache, and we always come up with lots of interesting plants. But one of the great laboratories for our ethnobotanical work is New York City. New York City is full of biodiversity, and all of the herb shops, the botanicas in the Latino culture, Chinese and Korean herb shops, they're just full of interesting things to study and document. And many hundreds of thousands of people in the city who've immigrated to New York still maintain their use of herbs that their cultures are based upon. And what we do is study with those folks and figure out where they get their herbs from. They might grow them in community gardens. They might purchase them from botanicas. They might pull them as weeds from sidewalks. Dr. Rosita Arvigo used to tell me stories of walking through Chicago as a young naturopathic physician and pulling weeds out between the cracks in the sidewalk, and they happen to be powerful medicines. So medicinal plants, ethnobotany, you can do it in your backyard or you can do it 10,000 miles away.
No, it's true, and it's always right outside your door. Now, in the book, and with, you know, focusing on that book today, although there's so much knowledge that Dr. Balick has, but we're looking at this beautiful book, 21st Century Herbal, Rodale's 21st Century Herbal, A Practical Guide for Living Using Nature's Most Powerful Plants. And when you say using, you have so many different kinds of uses that are possible with plants, not only, let's say, to make herb tea, not only for medicinal use, but you give so many great growing tips as well.
Yes, we've added, there is a section on cooking with herbs, how to use herbs to really spice up your culinary experience. There's a chapter on herbal health and healing. And my friend Tirona Lodog has contributed her top 25 most favorite herbs. There's a section on herbs for beauty and bath, how to enhance the experience, in the personal care arena. Using herbs in your home, how to clean with herbs. Now, you start looking at some of the chemicals on your beauty products and your cleaning products, and you start to wonder, after you get through the 15th or 20th ingredient that you can't pronounce, is this something I want on my skin? Is this something I want on my floor? And I always give my students a test, and that is to take a couple drops of peppermint oil and rub them between their thumb and forefinger. And within 30 seconds, you'll taste that peppermint in your mouth. Now, what does that mean? It means it's been absorbed through the skin, goes into the circulatory system, and is in your body. So I think about that when I grab the handrail of the subway in the morning, going down into the subway station. You know, what cleaning solution has been used to clean that handrail? or when I see little kids running around on a living room floor that's just been washed with a commercial cleaner, or someone washing dishes and absorb without gloves and absorbing all of those things in their bodies. So what we tried to do, Ellen, with this is come up with some good formulas for healthy use of herbs. And for example, you have a cutting board, right, in your house?
I do.
Lemon is a great way to clean it. Lemon really kills a lot of the bad things on a cutting board. Vinegar, a great household cleaner. In fact, I don't use vinegar as a salad dressing. I don't have a tolerance for it, but I use it as a weed killer in my garden.
Yeah, I've done that too.
It really knocks out the weeds without
And it's non-toxic.
Yes, exactly.
And even the scent is very short-lasting.
Yep.
So that's a good one. Well, we're going to go to one more break here so the station, Progressive Radio Network, can identify itself and tell us about some of the other great shows that they have on. And then we'll come back for our last segment. I want you to know, listeners, that you are really listening to a special guest today. As I'm sure you know, Dr. Michael Balick. And if you're enjoying this show and say, oh, I wish my friend could listen to it too, they can, because within a day or two, this show will be archived under Natural Nurse right on Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. And that is available for podcasting, downloading, and we do have listeners all over the country and the world because of that great asset that's part of Progressive Radio Network. So we will be right back with more. Stay tuned to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You can always get to us by going to naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And we're here with our guest today. For those of you just tuning in, we're having a discussion with Dr. Michael Balick. And he is a PhD in biology from Harvard University and Vice President for Botanical Science, and the curator of the Institute of Economic Botany at the New York Botanical Gardens. So if you're listening in the New York area, you want to go to that spot because there is so much going on there. Dr. Balick has described for us something that's available online called the Virtual Herbarium, and we're talking about his book, Rodale's 21st Century Herbal. And thank you so much for joining us again, Dr. Balick. We have great little stories within this book as well. I went to, just a little cocktail party recently, and someone brought out a drink that you write about in your book. It's actually on page 108, called the Green Fairy. And I had never heard that term, the Green Fairy, before. But I believe that this drink is now becoming more popular again. I'm not quite sure if it's totally legal or not, but it's called absinthe.
Yes. It was very, very popular in the times of Van Gogh, for example, the sort of Parisian bohemian scene. Oscar Wilde was a great fan. And it has a slightly toxic, actually fairly toxic compound, at least it did back then, called sujone. It's from artemisia. It's a distilled form of artemisia, which is a common weed in our city, also an important medicinal plant. And the sujone would provoke sort of a hallucination. And people would talk about the green fairy that they would see, a fairy with wings that they they called it the green hour between 5 and 7. You would sit and drink absinthe. And some people blame Van Gogh's cutting off his ear to sort of a delirious rage that was induced by the absinthe of the time. Now, these days it is legal, but it's not legal to have a huge thujone content in that drink. So it's a much sort of tamer beverage. It is very popular on campuses, and you can go in airports all over Europe and see different forms of absinthe, some mixed with other herbs. But yes, it had a great role in history of the arts and culture. The Bohemians were absolutely mad about it.
And, you know, those are little pieces of folklore that you could pick up looking at this book. And then I love the garden designs that you have. You talk about having a focus to a garden, like, for instance, a spiritual garden. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think gardens are places where we can get away from everything in our modern lives, and we can sit in a small garden and focus on the plants, on the experience. We can think about what's in there, what its history, what it's grown for. We can, especially with herbs, the mints and the oreganos and the sages, we can break off leaves and chew on them while we're thinking, and really have a spiritual experience with nature. You know, nature is absolutely essential to our well-being, and I think we need more nature rather than less, especially these days. I've sort of slowed down reading the daily papers with all the news, and I've tried to up my time spent out in nature, because I think nature's lessons have a counterbalance to everything we're having to deal with, unfortunately.
I think that's very wise, Dr. Balick, because just as a practitioner, I'm getting so many more patients recently coming in with anxiety, and they've never had anxiety before. I just had a woman come in the other day. She was 82, and she's waking up at night, and she's having minor heart palpitations. She went to the cardiologist, so he ruled out it being really a serious cardiac issue. And, you know, I asked her, do you watch the news every night before you go to bed? And she said she did. And I said, well, just don't. If you have to watch it like 3 in the afternoon. You know, she's not at work at that time. And then do something like what you're suggesting. Actually physically interact in something that's going to bring your stress level down.
I always find that a lavender bath is a good way to sort of calm down at night. Either you know, a dozen drops of lavender oil in a warm bath, or lavender diluted in a massage or carrier oil. It's absorbed through the skin easily. It has a wonderful aroma. In fact, both hops that we make beer from and lavender have been used in history to make what are called sleep pillows, that you stuff a pillow with either lavender or hops, flowers, and or both, and you lay your head on it, and it immediately will start to reduce your anxiety and help you sleep. So I think herbs are wonderful vehicles for de-stressing.
Now, when you're talking about an oil, that's something that's a little difficult to make at home unless people know how to do distillation. But how would one know they're getting a good quality oil? Because that, you know, ranges to just junk with chemicals in it to something that's really, really healing.
Well, I think you need to do some research and look at companies that have been in business for 20 or 30 or 40 years that are sold at reputable stores rather than, you know, mass market. you know, I'm not able to comment on brands.
Oh, you don't have to say a brand, but that's very good advice that you just gave. And once somebody does get a high-quality one, you can immediately learn very quickly that you will know the difference.
Absolutely.
And so if somebody did want to make their own, however, that's a little different. It wouldn't be as concentrated, but it certainly works really well.
Yes. You can actually, you can buy small distillation kits to make flower oils, but I've never been able to make mine work.
I go the very easy route. For instance, and this is not distillation, I'll take St. John's wort flowers in mid to late June when they're really out and flourishing, and cut the heads and actually just put it in sesame oil, the whole plant, and leave it on the windshield of my car where it's getting pretty intense sunlight. Mm-hmm. And that's an easy thing. And you actually see the oil turn red. That's one of the amazing things, of course, with St. John's wort oil rather than the yellow, which the flowers show.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's something that's fun and very easy without spending money on a distillation unit. But then if you find it's a love of your life, you can certainly bring those other tools in as well.
It is. It's quite fun, and some of these recipes provided in the book are great rainy day activities for the whole family. You know, sitting around the in the kitchen, stirring the pot, all of that.
Now, when you say the whole family, that's a really good point, because parents are always calling and saying, is it okay if I give my child, let's say, a natural cough syrup kind of preparation? And it's interesting to me that they would even be worried about that versus using the commercial medicines for children, OTCs, which have all kinds of dyes and chemicals in them.
Yes, one can make things that are good substitutes. Slippery elm, for example, is great for that sort of thing. But we don't give a whole lot of recipes in the book for that. That's where I say my patients are green, and I recommend integrative healers such as yourself.
Yeah, and it's wonderful. You give enough information on many of the plants, and you do talk about both the culinary use for kitchen, medicinal use, and ornamental use of the individual plants, but you're not going at it so much as a medicinal systems use, but you talk about it, the plant, and how it might be used that way as well. And you do have some very specific recipes for the natural home cleaning, which you talked about earlier, but they are excellent. Like, you talked about vinegar. Here's one, kitchen countertop spray. This is so inexpensive. People sometimes say, oh, natural cleaning products are expensive. No, they're actually less expensive and so much safer. You talk about white vinegar, water, and just 10 to 12 drops of geranium essential oil, which is highly antimicrobial. And also, by the way, does not cause the development of resistant strains, like something like triclosan will do in the commercial preparations.
Yes, and you can do something similar with spearmint to make a scrubber for cleaning cookware and countertops. You use a cup of baking soda, a tablespoon of liquid Castile soap, 10 to 12 drops of spearmint essential oil, and some warm water, combining all of the above to form a thick but very pourable paste. You would put it on the countertop, wait 5 minutes, and then scrub it off. So there's lots of interesting things you can make with herbs. And probably the first cleaners were only had one or two ingredients, and then through better living through chemistry and technology and
that's a good way to put it.
You know, it just, everything evolved to 20 ingredients that we can't pronounce. So,
it's so true.
Yeah.
Well, you have such wonderful information, great programs available at the New York Botanical Gardens. What is the best way for people to see more about you, your work, and how they can come and enjoy the gardens?
Well, nybg.org is the source of lots of information on exhibitions, We're about to launch our Kiku Japanese chrysanthemum exhibition. That's a big hit. So if you're in the area, please come by. We're easy to get to. Each of the scientists at the garden, and we have a scientific staff of around 125 people, PhDs, graduate students, lots of people who work doing botany overseas. We all have web pages, and on mine I've put PDFs of every paper I've ever written, starting in the 1970s, that are downloadable for free. So nybg.org is rich in information. You can get to our library, you can get to our herbarium through there, and we're building more and more every day.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Michael Balick, author of Rodale's 21st Century Herbal and so much more. Thank you again on behalf of myself and Dr. Eugene Zamperone. Listeners, we hope that you stay healthy.
Wonderful to be with you today. Thank you.